to the Atropexia Podcast. My name is Marie Gottschreck, and my humanities background is philosophy and Latin. My usual co-hosts.
I'm Michael, the history guy.
And I'm Corey, the English major.
All right, so today I'm wearing two hats. I'm going to be presenting things as the physician that I am, and then otherwise, though, I'll be generally trying to talk as a philosopher. So the opinions contained within are not necessarily my medical opinions at all, but other opinions, because I'm a multi-faceted person and all that jazz.
She also just delivered a bold-faced lie. She doesn't have a single hat on.
So, yep. So the mad literalist strikes again. It's going to be a great day. So what we're actually going to do is, because I hear a lot from, and I myself say, if only we dealt with these medical issues, like, from the humanities perspective, I'm sure we'd come up with more reasonable, you know, solutions than necessarily from science, because science is so rigid. So we're going to kind of talk in a public health point of view. I'm going to present a couple of major issues in Canadian healthcare, and then we're going to come up with how we'd fix them by arguing. This is what people in humanities like to do.
Yeah, okay, I don't think we're even remotely qualified to weigh in on this,
nope.
But sure, let's have some fun.
Let us justify our chosen fields of study.
So, you know, university, not just for getting that BA in business. Okay. So
I don't think you can get a BA in business. I think it's like actually a bachelor's of business, not arts.
I wouldn't know. I haven't done one. So.
Anyway.
Meh.
That's philosophy.
Meh.
All right. So I'm just going to go over a couple of definitions so that you guys do know these parts that come from the public health sphere. We're going to be kind of talking about things in the branch of epidemiology, which is a branch of medicine that deals with incidence, distribution, and possible control of diseases and other factors relating to health. Which is basically, like, where it happens, why it happens, and how often it happens, and how do you deal with that? There's a lot of stats. So if you like stats, it's a place to go. An outbreak is the occurrence of a disease in a community that has never had it before, or where cases of that disease occur in greater numbers than expected in an area. So it's kind of similar to an epidemic, which is an increase, often sudden, in the number of cases of disease above what is normally expected in a population in that area. So a lot of this has to do with how you define a population. Outbreaks are generally smaller, because you think about an outbreak within, like, a village. But an epidemic would be within an area. Whereas pandemic...
Sorry. So just to make sure I've got this clear,
yeah.
An outbreak is local, an epidemic is regional, effectively.
I'm sure if we actually had, like, a public health physician here, they'd be, you know, simmering in the background about how I've not described this properly, but that's okay. So a pandemic, it's a board game, but also it's an epidemic that has spread over several countries or continents, usually affecting a large number of people, so it's a really big epidemic. And then I just want to talk about levels of prevention, because this is actually going to be kind of key on what we're going to do, because we're going to talk about solving big-ticket healthcare issues in Canadian healthcare and in healthcare in other places. So you've got primary, secondary, and tertiary levels of prevention. So, Corey, you're totally staring at my script here, but I'm just curious, can you guys guess what that means, what those are?
So I would guess primary is just simple basic things you can do to prevent getting sick, so washing your hands. Secondary would be, I guess, more advanced things, vaccinations, regular checkups, and I have no idea what you could go beyond that to be in tertiary, so...
Okay, let's see what the historian says.
Literally the only thing I have here is that this is a scale. So I could help. It's either you
well
sort it by importance or by time. So if I were to go by importance, then primary would be at the immediate moment of the outbreak, what can be done to contain it from spreading. Secondary stuff you could maybe do earlier that would help, and then tertiary being related stuff.
This is important because people in science always think that their things make sense in and of themselves, like that they're
self-evident.
Oh, and our fourth host, Niall, who's gonna just friggin'
the podcast kitty.
Yay. Well, anyway. So primary prevention is what you do with a population who's well, so people who aren't actually sick yet. And primary prevention is... Niall, for God's sake. Nope, that didn't work. Is health promotion and addressing risk factors, social and genetic factors. So basically working with people and being like, don't get sick. Here's what you do to not get sick. Like education. That kind of stuff. That's primary prevention. Never get this thing and you do it with everybody all the time. All right, secondary prevention is when you have people who are at risk of developing a health problem. Good example is hypertension. So then what you want to do is you'd have regular screening. So screening is something that is likely to pick something up, but not going to give you too high a false positive rate, is cheap and doesn't cause harm to your population. And the idea is to figure out people who you can get on to, like, preventative treatment with, prophylactic treatment. And so then you'd be controlling risk factors and intervening early. So, for example, if you're thinking of, like, heart attacks and strokes, you have everyone who goes into a GP's clinic gets a blood pressure done. And that's because it's really cheap and easy to do, and you catch people with high blood pressure, and then you treat the high blood pressure, and they may never get a stroke or a heart attack. That's it. that's like a secondary prevention. A tertiary prevention is when you have someone who already have the health problem, and that means like you're preventing what's called sequelae, or things that follow from a disease. So you can have things like a rehabilitating an injury, or you can prevent complications like good glycemic control and diabetes, and then events that improve quality of life so that they're less likely to become sick or put themselves at risk. And so at that point, you're really just sort of damage control is tertiary prevention. It's kind of what you're thinking of there. So
the opposite of what I guessed.
Pretty much.
Still on that scale. Awesome.
Yeah, it's a scale. Well done. Yeah. All right, so we're going to talk about a couple of different epidemics. I've chosen five. We'll see how we do with each of them. Some of them may be really fast. So I'm going to propose what the issue is, and then I'd like to hear from you what we think of ways that you'd solve it, assuming you had whatever at your disposal. We should think about how funding would be allocated. The one thing we're not going to consider is how to pass a bill in Parliament, because that's a whole different issue, which is part of this issue, but I'm just going to constrain our thought exercise from that point of view.
Okay.
So otherwise, though, trying to think in the real world, what would you do if you could just tell people to do things? So one issue. In Canada, we have rising syphilis, chlamydia, and gonorrhea. I don't know if you knew that.
No, I did not.
It's actually been rising steadily. Generally in younger people. But actually now we're also seeing it in middle age and beyond, in geriatric populations as well. So, how are you guys going to fix that?
Okay, well, I think the first step would be... Okay, first off, education. Promote the fact that this is an issue and let people know it's happening. The second approach would be to advocate and inform people of safe sex practices.
That's still education.
That's still education. Yep.
Okay,
yeah,
fine.
Good
so,
job.
Okay, so first step is education. Let people know this is happening. Let people know how to prevent it. Like, I think those two things alone would do a ton of good. Third step, and this kind of ties in with your second or however we're covering this, and this still kind of ties in with education, is while increasing awareness, also kind of work towards increasing cultural acceptance of being screened. So encourage people to go get screened for these kind of things, to see if they have them, and to let them know what their treatment options are.
Hmm.
That one sounds pretty straightforward to me. I don't know. Michael?
I'll when I thought of it, the first thing I went to was education is the most important element here.
God, you guys are such, like, university types. Yeah. Education, man.
But we also have to think of what we can do in terms of prevention. I'm assuming this is something where wearing condoms is kind of important, right?
Yeah, it is. And one of the, obviously, and one of the things is that we're wondering in older populations if it has to do with people not knowing that condoms are for STI prevention, but that they're for, like, preventing pregnancy, which we're not actually brilliant at, but anyway. So there's a decent number of people who, once they sort of hit menopause, kind of go, don't have to worry about this stuff anymore. And, yeah.
Well, again, that still falls under education, though, because mm-hmm. if that's simply a matter of people not knowing something, mm-hmm. the only way you're going to have a positive impact is to inform them of it.
So,
education and
thing.
Distribution in this case.
Yeah. Accessibility.
Mm-hmm. So how are you actually going to do that, though? Because it's easy to be like, oh, we'll educate people. I think that's being tried.
Yeah.
I feel like the public health forces. I mean, I read the update on it today on a CBC article from May of this year, 2016, about it. And then I'm like, oh, they're all going up, because I thought it was just syphilis. But after that, they're all going up now. So,
I guess
my question to you then is, yeah.
I guess we haven't seen a public service advertising campaign on this at all, which may be part of it. But how long of a duration would you run that for when you maybe don't want to just hit people with the message in a short period of time? You want to be running these messages out at a constant. Hey, here's a reminder. And then there's the case of, is this something television stations want to run?
Well, and I think the other part of the problem you kind of encounter as well is this is dealing with sex, and cultural attitudes towards sex can sometimes be very prudish and very closed-minded. And even if it's well-meaning, even if it's important to know this kind of thing, a lot of people are very uncomfortable discussing it.
Mm-hmm. And as you said earlier, people don't want to go in to get tested because it's something you want to shut your ears about.
Yeah. And earlier, Corey said screening. I wouldn't say this is something that you screen for, necessarily, because it would be difficult to find a screening that would be cheap. Because the only... And how would you screen? Because the only real way, which it could be maybe taking urine samples and then culturing them, but that's actually quite a lot if you did that to every single person at risk of developing this for that purpose only. Yeah, I think you might get a lot of false positives of other things. So, and one of the things people don't know is that you're generally asymptomatic, or you won't notice it. Like in syphilis, you develop something called a chancre. Well, initially, primary syphilis is you get like a sort of a flu-y sort of thing. So you're just kind of sick. Like there's nothing obvious about it. Then you get a chancre sore, which is a sort of painless sore in the genital area, and then that is often not even noticed by the person who has it because it doesn't hurt. The tertiary syphilis is that neurosyphilis and all that kind of stuff. That happens years and years later. So people carry syphilis for a long period of time. And chlamydia, often you don't even have obvious symptoms for it, but it can lead to like big issues like scarring of fallopian tubes, inability to be pregnant later in your life. And if there's chlamydia around, if there's gonorrhea, chlamydia is probably there. These days we actually just assume chlamydia is also present. Because it's generally silent, is what we consider it in healthcare. Whereas, and gonorrhea, like, I mean, people have heard, like, it burns when you pee, you get a little bit of pus coming out or something. But often, they both don't really have that much in the way of symptoms. And so a lot of times, people don't know they have it.
Which means this puts most of the weight on prevention.
Yeah, because people who know that they have it know they have it. And I remember one education campaign at the University of Alberta, had in the bathrooms, like, in front of the men's bathrooms, they'd had, hi, Niall. They had pictures of tennis balls that were on fire, which I thought was cute.
I remember that one.
Yeah, so, like, that's, like, a basic educational campaign. Other places I could see would be, like, YouTube, but then you have to compete with advertisers who have more money. Right? So how are you going to actually get that message out?
Well, I mean, One way is you could have doctors talk about it, but I think the inevitable problem with that is it puts more weight on the physician with everything else they've already got to deal with or screen for or inform their patients of.
Yeah, and I mean, time in a healthcare clinic is already sort of a issue.
Which makes information sessions something that needs to be contracted out. As opposed to something that can be done in-house in the hospital, and then we don't know what the success rate of attendance would be towards something like that, because it's a fairly common government thing to do, and you hold your workshop, and then nobody comes.
Yeah, and I wouldn't do it in a hospital. I'd try to keep, like, primary prevention things entirely out of hospitals. Mm-hmm. I think hospitals should be for tertiary and secondary prevention entirely.
The problem remains, however.
Yeah. In some clinics, you could have multidisciplinary teams, and sometimes these do run groups with education, but who are you going to get about it? And a lot of the time, like, you put it into periodic health examinations, which is the old yearly checkup. Those are now sort of changing in primary care into sort of less being about, you know, doing the physical exam and history, more about doing this education piece, because a lot of the, like, for example, doing breast exams is not particularly useful in finding a lump, or, you know, and you could better spend that time talking about stuff like this with the patients and letting them know about safe sex. And as always, there's getting them while they're young, because people who are in school are very easy to be told things because they're there.
Yeah, so you want to get into the schools, but then you have teachers who don't want to talk about it or who feel extremely embarrassed talking about these topics, and the onus is generally
there's a number. Teachers might not be comfortable teaching it. Two, parents might not be comfortable having it taught to their kids. The third one is teachers have their own biases as well. So who's to say a teacher is going to be teaching it correctly or giving kids accurate information?
Use a condom. Like, that's the information that needs to be given in this case.
Here's the thing. Like, a lot of teachers, for various personal, moral, religious reasons, consider that wrong to teach. Mm-hmm. So what if they're not teaching it? How do you validate? Like, I mean, it's great to say teach it in schools, but how do you ensure it's being taught accurately?
One way
is to bring in outside experts, but again, how do you screen those people? How do you make sure they're doing their job properly?
And bringing in representatives solely for that is either taking away resources from what their regular job would be, or having to hire people on an interpreter's budget.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there's also the whole... And just, like, sort of related to this is, like, the HPV vaccine issue seen in Calgary when that was being rolled out, where the Catholic School Board would not allow it to be given. I think that has been rescinded later, but that is a great example of a primary prevention. You take a well population, you vaccinate them, they cannot get a disease that leads to a type of cancer, regardless of what they do. And yet, for theological or ideological issues, people were against this, and yeah, sex is messy. But come on, guys, you're in the humanities. You should be able to, like, deal with this stuff. Scientists are like, I don't understand why you don't want to take information that makes sense, and then they walk away.
Well, you need to be looking toward communication methods that are outside of what a government would typically do in those situations. But it's not simply a case of, oh, I'll make a smartphone app. You need to think a little bit more deeply about it than that.
And again, the problem is we're talking about people viewing this as a moral issue.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, you're talking about overcoming people's deep-seated beliefs and biases. And I mean, you might disagree with them and think they're foolish, but that doesn't change the fact that these people still believe it strongly. And ridiculing them is not going to make them change their mind.
Mm-hmm.
In which case you need to skirt that head-on confrontation entirely, which is not what some people working on this issue have done.
I disagree. I think skirting the confrontation is not what to do, but the practice of active listening to their point of view and then trying to reach a compromise with these people is probably better. You're still going to reach this sort of head-butting point, but at least you're trying. You can be ethically the better person, right?
Engaging in conversation rather than avoiding it. But that's not what communications in government is about.
Michael has no affiliation to any government institution.
I am not speaking in that capacity, at least at this moment.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right. Well, I feel like we've probably exhausted the syphilis, chlamydia, gonorrhea outbreak in Canada. So people, sure, abstinence is great. But I'd wear a condom with all sexual activities. Forever. Like, people are surprised when I've told them in clinic, you should just keep wearing condoms. And they're like, but I've been married for like 50 years. I'm like, you should still use a condom. Just do it, okay? It's an industry I'm happy to see flourish. All right, next one. Diabetes.
Okay, so as long as we're trying to get censored by the entire internet...
What?
Oh, just you seem to be picking very flame war heavy topics.
Well, these are flame war topics because they're really problematic. And these are things, and the less so the STI one, but more these upcoming ones. These are the ones that are going, that cost to the healthcare system lots of money and could potentially bring our socialist style of healthcare just crashing down from the sheer amount of funding required for this. If the diabetes epidemic is not controlled better. So I'm not talking about type 1 diabetes, which is people who have autoimmunity to their own pancreatic islet cells that create insulin and destroy them at a young age. That's something else. I'm talking about diabetes mellitus type 2, which is usually seen in older populations. By older, I mean like 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond. People who are at risk for developing diabetes type 2 have metabolic syndrome, which is a cluster of conditions like increased blood pressure, high blood sugar, excess body fat around the waist, and abnormal cholesterol triglyceride levels, and these things also raise your risk of heart disease and stroke at the same time. So, that's a metabolic syndrome. You know that in people who have diabetes, that when you look at the population statistically, like the epidemiology, you know that there are risk factors associated with developing diabetes, but just to be clear, you can never say to each person exactly why they have developed diabetes. You can make guesses, but there's a lot of times on the internet, I think this is the sort of the flame part, where people blame people who have diabetes for getting it. They basically say that you're fat, you're lazy, you're terrible, this is your own damn fault. That's not always necessarily the case. They could have a strong genetic predisposition towards it. They might live in a food desert where they can't get food, get healthier, organic,
flaxseed,
just smoothie, green foods, or whatever you think is going to help.
Or just even, you know, real fruits and vegetables.
Yeah, like, and this is going to tie into our next epidemic issue, too. It's never okay to blame the person who has diabetes themselves for having it. They have it, or they may be at risk of developing it, and we can't help with it.
Unlike that one terrible issue of the Gateway that I remember from the University of Alberta.
Oh yeah, what did they say?
It was one of their joke issues where they said, it's your fault for eating sugar.
Yeah, I mean, I'm currently eating hummus on a cracker, but, you know, I just realized that. But for breakfast, I had pumpkin pie, so there you go. I will tell you that in a GP's clinic, when you have somebody who's first diagnosed with diabetes type 2, generally, this is either done because you screened their blood sugar, so just as a screening, like taking the general blood work and a periodic health examination, you see their blood sugar is high, their what's called an HbA1c level is high, you don't need to know what that is, just know that it can tell you that somebody has diabetes, and, or they come in with symptoms of a lot of excessive thirst, a lot of urination, and feeling kind of generally unwell. Potentially losing weight, maybe not at this stage in the process, and you can make the diagnosis based on those clinical symptoms and workup. Generally, once you first have that diagnosis, you do lifestyle changes is the first thing you try. You tell people to exercise more, you give them nutritional guidelines. If you're working in a multidisciplinary clinic, you'll refer them to a dietitian, and then for giving them actual diabetes-specific advice. Then you'll follow up and see whether or not the issue has remitted. If it has not, then you move on to treatment with medications. Just so that you know kind of what the general trajectory of a person first diagnosed with diabetes looks like. As far as I know, I mean, I'm not a general practitioner, and that's not my area of specialty, so nor is endocrinology. But anyway. So, we've got a lot of people with diabetes these days. I kind of told you some of the risk factors for it. How do you think we're going to fix this problem?
All right, so what strikes me as kind of one of the easiest and most successful options in theory, and I say in theory because I don't think it would ever be, there's any practical way this can be implemented, would be some form of regulation on what food is made available. So that would mean limiting the amount of sugar manufacturers can put in products. That would mean requiring grocery stores to carry, you know, healthy produce and healthy food and real food. And it would require, you know, nutritional labels that were very clear, that spelled things out in a way people could understand. Now, the problem with that is the second you start having that kind of regulation, you get pushback from the business community, some of which is probably justified. I mean, mm-hmm. at the end of the day, yes, a business is a business. And yeah. if they're not selling something because it's not making money, well, okay, while that might seem horrible from a health perspective, you have to be able to appreciate their view as well.
I'd just even say that if you force someone to say they all have to have fresh produce, I can see that being really expensive in some communities. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know, Michael, you live in Whitehorse.
Well, this is one common issues with providing healthy food in the North. We've had the Nutrition North program and trying to get stuff out to communities. The simple fact is you try and ship out fresh produce to Old Crow, the shelf life is very short because of the amount of time it takes mm-hmm. to transport something like that over there. In which case, mm-hmm. for the population to have mm-hmm. healthy food, they need to be relying on other means, usually pointing towards traditional lifestyles of hunting, mm-hmm. picking rose hips and other kinds of things out of the forest, anything that you can do to supplement what cannot be provided from a supermarket.
Which works really great in communities that are downstream from industrial places. Not naming any in particular.
Okay, well, let's say we ignore the, you know, being downstream from an industrial site. That idea actually sounds fairly sound. The problem is there's a pretty big limit on where that can be implemented. If you're in kind of a rural area, sure. It's easy to just say, okay, we're going to go into the woods, we're going to take advantage of what was this traditional food stuff, we're going to find it, we're going to cultivate it even. But if you live in the middle of a city, and there's simply just no grocery stores providing that kind of food around, and it's not within your means or ability to go further out to find them, how do you address that?
That is actually called a food desert, you're talking about there. That's like people who only have like the Max or 7-Eleven or convenience store down the road, and so they end up buying like chips.
Well, I mean, it's
salty, nasty food because that's what's there. And if you have four kids at home and you're on the way from home from work, you don't have a car. How are you going to get to that?
Especially because we've largely mm-hmm. moved away from local production, which is something that, as a whole, it benefits a country to have local production because the transportation costs are that much lower.
Okay, well, maybe there's a method that could be or should be considered and could be beneficial: is find ways to encourage local production. I mean, if it's implemented the right way, and again, I have no idea what the right way would be, that's why I'm saying that, the right way. But, no, if it's done the right way, you could encourage local production, so you'd be helping with the food issue. You could encourage business, because, you know, there would be some smart, enterprising people who would find a way to make a business model that worked.
There are, like, green box programs and things like that.
So it can be done in such a way where it does actually provide stimulation to the economy and helps the people who need this food.
There.
Now, again, that's going to be an incredibly difficult thing to implement. It's probably not going to be cheap to start up, even mm-hmm. if it pays for itself long term.
Well, the thing is that it won't pay for itself in any sort of way that a general person will appreciate. The only thing, the payment that you get is that later on, this person does not have the health condition and doesn't cost the healthcare system lots of money in terms of optometry visits, in terms of renal dialysis, in terms of needing amputations because there's no more circulation to their feet from diabetes. Like, these are the end products of diabetes. That's what happens. And then these people become very comorbid and they're in and out of hospitals frequently and then they die. Like, they die young and they die from infections because they don't have the ability to fight them off. One thing is that those things are kind of great, but I mean, even you and I, who are relatively middle class, Corey, don't buy things at the farmer's market because it's expensive. And the people who need this are generally lower socioeconomic status who cannot afford this food. And that's why they get diabetes.
I think we don't live in a food desert either. There is at least one grocery store within walking distance that carries produce.
But even when you look in a grocery store about how much things cost, like consider how much like a red pepper costs. Per weight, that can be as much as some meat, right? And when you think of what fills you up, potatoes fill you up great, and they're relatively cheap, and they're just starch, and you put salt and butter on them, and it's a meal, right? And people who have trouble, who don't have the income to actually purchase things that are healthier, then get stuck in the spiral, is that you're poor? So you can't get the food, so you get the disease, and then that disease makes it so that you can't make more money because you have to pay for healthcare issues, because not every drug or everything is covered. The best stuff is not covered, generally. And then you're going to have all this comorbidity, and then you're stuck in a death spiral.
Well, we have this area that you can have a community greenhouse in your neighborhood, and you can ask people to grow their own food, but then we don't necessarily have people in urban areas who have the skills to disseminate telling people this is how you do it, because if you don't know about the crop cycle, if you don't know basic things, you can try and throw a few seeds into a bed and you won't get anything out of it. The amount of food, even in a community greenhouse, you have to wait for the harvest. The amount of food you're producing isn't going to be that much unless you can start working on a larger scale, unless you have communal operations. And in that case, you need to have an area where it can be done. It involves a lot.
So you need a farmer.
Yeah, it involves a lot of urban planning considerations to have these things in a city. Even in the countryside, access is going to be a problem. On the other hand, I think it's kind of the way you have to go.
Well, as you say, one idea that's actually very similar to that, I've seen, you know, documentaries and read articles. I don't think anybody's figured it out quite yet, but there are various groups of scientists looking to make this a reality.
So science has the answer? It's supposed to be humanities. Come on, guys.
Scientists had the idea. It's up to the humanities to advocate for it.
Cross-disciplinary.
There we go. Basically, skyscraper greenhouses. So the way, my understanding of how this idea works is that you literally build these towers in a city block. So it takes up, I mean, surface area, it only takes up the same footprint or the same space as, you know, an apartment building. But the thing is, you build vertically, and each floor is actually, you know, a hydroponics facility, or, I mean, effectively a grow-up, but instead of growing marijuana, you're growing food. And the thing about it is, you can build these things really tall, so volume-wise, you can have a lot of productive farm space in a city, so it's really close by, it's really easy access, but it doesn't take up vast swaths of countryside, so, I mean, again, it would be literally in the middle of downtown, there's a giant farm. Now, I don't know that anybody's figured out quite how to make them work yet, which is part of the problem.
I feel like energy's probably
the problem. I was going to say, I think energy's one of the concerns. I think finding out how to get that much light in is another concern. Like, there's a lot of issues that need to be solved, but it kind of strikes me as being on the right path, at least.
It's also what we're talking one thing about seems pretty indirect, and it becomes a promotional issue of how do you convince legislatures and so on, and even the people in general who are paying the taxes to support your great growing operations, that actually this has a huge benefit, does trickle down into reducing healthcare costs, which is what we're talking about.
Because, I mean, when someone came into this podcast at this moment and heard us talking about this, they have no idea that we're talking about diabetes.
Exactly.
Right? And this is the problem with public health, is that people have a very hard time believing what to them seems like magical connections, really. That, like, how is this thing related to this thing? But it is actually really obviously related. If you don't get good food and healthy food, you eat only crappy food, you're going to get a metabolic syndrome, probably, and then do unwell, and then you're at a higher risk for diabetes and the genetic factors and blah, 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 blah. One thing is that, like, when you're talking, when we were talking about having, like, the smaller plots that each person can make their own food, who has time for that? Specifically, yeah. Who has time for that in, among people who don't earn a living wage? The living wage is a big topic right now.
This is a but if part somebody's... of it that we're talking about North America in specific, where this isn't, this is not a yeah. common thing. If yeah. we're going to talk about yeah. Eastern Europe, where it's already...
I said in this podcast we're talking about yeah, Canadian
I know we're
healthcare
talking
issues.
About Canada, but this
okay,
is moving
so
towards...
carry on.
We have examples of societies where it's common in rural areas to have farmers who have small plots, and that's how they supplement their income as well.
Was that not how some things were done throughout history? You tell me, you're the historian.
Yes, this is going earlier to what a peasant plot would look like in the Middle Ages, except in this case, they're not giving over a big chunk of their harvest towards their lord.
Yeah.
You're bringing it to market, you're giving it to mm-hmm. other people who live in urban centers, you go a little bit into town, they're not necessarily doing this, but they can pick up that food. Usually at a cheaper price than if they went to the supermarket. It's the opposite case here where you have small farming operations. That food's going to be sold as organic, great stuff. It's going to be more expensive when you go to the market.
Which has really led to its own problem. Because if it was actually cheaper, then I think more people would buy local.
Exactly.
Because that is the invisible hand of economics.
Because the transportation costs... is a huge part yeah. of what we're paying for food. You lower
well,
that.
We're getting really far removed here because, mm-hmm. I mean, again, we're talking about how mm-hmm. ultimately it seems the best way to help prevent healthcare costs or reduce healthcare costs is to just radically overhaul our social structure. Now, I think there are
what
many,
a shock!
No, I think there are many good arguments, not just from a healthcare perspective, but from many perspectives of why that needs to happen. But it's really difficult to do. It's easy to say we need to overhaul this thing, but it takes a lot of people working in cooperation.
This is why I said at the beginning we weren't going to talk about trying to get these things passed into law, because the whole political science of this of these issues is just... We'd never finished talking.
Yeah,
so
part of the reason you wanted to have this podcast, Marie, is so that we could expand out the conversation to what's the solution to this? Something that seems completely unrelated, but because we're thinking on this level.
Mm-hmm. Let's kind of go to the other main thing that the person diagnosed with diabetes would do, would have done first time, which is, exercise changes. This, you would think, would be easier to do. Encouraging people to have, I think, one example is if you have, like, a 30 minutes of walking a day, the healthcare benefits are huge. I'll put a link to that video in the description beneath this podcast. But how do you actually encourage exercise? And what is exercise? How do you do
you
that?
Make exercise not feel like exercise.
See, you pole dance, like that's a great example.
Well, I mean, one of the simple answers to that question is you encourage people to find something that is physical activity that they enjoy doing. I mean, dance, martial arts, playing sports, going for walks with a pet. Those are all great examples. But not everything appeals to everyone, for starters. Mm-hmm. You're not going to find a universal form of exercise.
Taking the stairs? Changing your commute into cycling or walking?
Well, and the second problem is that just about all of these things cost money. Mm-hmm. Like, the one form of free exercise you can get is to walk or run, and even then, running is not necessarily an easy thing to start, because you need proper shoes for that, and those aren't cheap. And again, people might not enjoy it, so it can be quite difficult.
There's also perceived ideas of what quote-unquote exercise means, that I need to get a gym membership because exercise means getting that slim, awesome bod that I see on the television. It does not mean doing the few things necessary to keep my body in a workable state, which does not mean looking like that.
Again, and this ties back to a social issue. You're talking about altering a mass social perception of what something is. And, I mean, I think there are many people on the individual level who are able to recognize that, but it's still, even for people who recognize it, it's hard to fight against a social perception.
I think when you talk about specifically a gym, because I do think that building like a wellness center where anybody in the public can go and swim and exercise, workout and run if they want to, is actually a really good primary prevention. And having that facility available is, I think, important also for communities to have, you know, places where kids can play soccer and whatever, right?
Well, I mean, community rec centers.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I think those are actually great. The problem, I think, is that if you go to any gym and you're overweight and you're starting to try to become fit, it's a very hostile environment to be in.
Anyone with the slightest social anxiety issue is not going to want to go there. Yeah.
Or body dysmorphia.
Exactly.
And you have to remember that in a lot of people who have a really severe metabolic syndrome, exercise itself can be difficult and painful and hard. They may have enough mass that walking causes extreme knee pain, and they can't walk for more than 15 minutes without hurting. And like then you know, there's creative things you can do, like there's the hand. I don't know if you've ever seen these. Usually you only see these in occupational therapy, is the hand bicycles, which is not cool to do, but it's something. But when you get people who are at this point, that they're already unhealthy in this sort of ability to tolerate exercise, ability to tolerate movement, they will try once or twice, and it just becomes very difficult, and it's discouraging for them. So a lot of that is like if you have groups where people who have similar issues in your clinic, you can promote health. You could probably promote health by saying this would be like by putting together people who are working together similarly to go and exercise at the same time. Geriatric patients sometimes they have trouble going to exercise. Maybe they have cognitive issues where the physically doing the thing, coming back is not something they can do. That said, when I used to work out a long time ago, there was a pair of, like, 80-year-olds who kicked my butt every day. And one of them wore a suit! And it was so disheartening as a 15-year-old to see this guy whoop ya.
Yeah. Part of that is building up a community of mutual support in cases like that.
I do find that the dialogue's a little bit better these days. That people are not so much talking about, like, the Diet Lifestyle magazine things, and we're talking more about, I just want to be healthier. And I tend to take the stairs at work all the time. It's kind of funny, the cardiac surgeons say take the stairs, and the orthopedic surgeons say take the elevator. So take the stairs going up, it's mechanically good for you, and it's a workout, but apparently going down, you better take the elevator for your joints, fun fact. whatever. So, and I try to walk as much as I can, and I'm lucky because I can live a pedestrian cycling lifestyle, but think of all the people who are stuck in a desk job, who have to drive to get to work, and where is the time of the day or the ability in the day to have wellness?
Well, we're thinking about desk jobs. There's also some simple things like having a stand-up desk, but then that involves investment on the part of a private company to make sure those resources are available to their employees. I think it's a good investment.
Standing desks. Again, if somebody is starting at a position where standing for a period of time would not be feasible.
Yeah, that's why...
You do have ones that like, modify, like, they go up and down.
I think all standing desks that I've seen, at least, are adjustable. Mine at work is every day.
Yoga ball chair, I believe, is actually not a panacea, as originally thought.
No.
It's actually not that ergonomically good for you. So, fun fact. And another important thing with like diabetes and overall weight gain is it's not just diet and exercise was the point of this conversation. It's a huge many issues altogether. Last thing would be like talking about diabetes. If we're talking about like tertiary prevention, so people who have diabetes and maybe they're on insulin, it would be trying to maximize their education on what they can eat in terms of calorie count, not calorie counting, but sugar counts, and then using right amount of insulin. Can they use an insulin pump? And the tertiary prevention, I think we're not that as bad at, because we have a lot of endocrine clinics or nurse practitioners and family health teams that will educate people and follow up with them to keep working on this. Yeah. So, diabetes, it's difficult.
Well, I just, actually, before we continue, just had the ultimate solution for how we could ensure everyone has an easy supply of healthy, nutritious food. Mm-hmm. Replicators from Star Trek. Science, get on that.
Thanks. I honestly thought that you were going to say a modest proposal. But anyway.
No.
If we could just live in the universe from the Diamond Age.
Yeah.
No, that would be horrible for other reasons, but...
Or that Doctor Who article where your fat just walks away. Not article, episode that, where your fat just walks away.
Yeah, that was a disturbing
one. Adipose!
Yeah.
But they're so cute! They're these, like, little walking blobs of fat with smiley faces.
I remember thinking, I'm like, that is the dumbest thing I've seen in a long time. But anyway. Alright, diabetes. Also costs lots of money because of OR costs and dialysis, and anyway, yeah, I'm gonna skip that because I don't want to spend forever on just these two. So, on reserves and other Aboriginal areas, we have really poor health.
Okay, so before we get into this one, because you asked Michael and I here for the humanities perspective.
Yep.
This is problematic to even start talking
this
about.
This is not simply a health issue, yes.
No. One of the big problems, and one of the very big black marks on Canada's kind of history, if you will.
And current events.
Well, current events are part of history, but whenever there's been kind of any interaction with Native or with First Nations communities, any attempt to do anything for First Nations communities, there's inevitably this paternalistic attitude where people like us who are in a fairly privileged position just start making decisions and deciding things. I mean, ultimately, the biggest issue when dealing with the First Nations communities is that they're very seldom actually involved in the decisions that will affect them. And so I think for us to be having this conversation...
It's colonial.
There's a certain colonial aspect to even talking about this to begin with. Now, I mean, we can be well-intentioned, and I think we can still have the conversation, but I think that needs to be had in the context of we need to understand that First Nations people also need to be included in their own decisions.
Part of this is not only coming up with a solution on the part of people from the dominant culture, colonial, the problem results from colonialism too.
Yeah, like destruction of culture. Rampantly.
Destruction of culture.
Reservation system, shoving people into the worst, least productive parts of the country. if you pay attention to all the articles that come out every few months, the solution proposed is obviously Zeppelins, apparently. This comes up constantly.
Okay.
This is not something we're going to be considering here. I just thought it...
But you love Zeppelins.
I love Zeppelins, but it keeps on coming up. This is how we're going to supply remote First Nation communities. Zeppelins. There you go. Yes, I wish the solution were that easy to...
Okay, so I think...
Okay, so that's a good caveat for this discussion that we are going to have. We're going to pretend that we're policymakers and that we are supposed to be charged with trying to solve issues. I am keeping it as the health issues here because that's what this podcast is about. So, particularly, I think you could look at things like poor water quality. Diabetes is huge in First Nations. Substance abuse. Huge in First Nations communities, but that's not like a throughout the case. But when you look at basically everything in med school, when you're taught a med school lecture and you're like, what are factors associated with getting this disease? It's pretty much always being an Aboriginal person in Canada is going to make you more likely to develop whatever disease. It's basically the shittiest thing that you could do to somebody. We just put them somewhere and not help them.
Well, I think ultimately, certain forms of disease and substance abuse certainly, mm-hmm. are largely linked to living in an impoverished life. Mm-hmm. And this ties into what we were just talking about, how there has been a very systematic impoverishing of First Nations.
And even in the case of treatment, there's a difficulty getting doctors and nurses to go into rural areas in the first place. They mm-hmm. don't want to work there.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the time, people who are white privileged physicians, such as, say, myself, or similar people will have a frustrating time just because often these patients won't have clinic follow-ups, won't come to your clinic, won't by your perception do the things that you're recommending them to do. And some of it may be like we were talking earlier, how like eat well is like an easy thing to say, but it's not necessarily an easy thing to do. I do strongly believe that the systematic destruction in culture is what leads to a lot of the suicidal ideation in these communities, to a lot of the substance abuse. When you don't know who you are, how are you supposed to locate yourself as anyone? Like, your identity, how are you going to come up with any coping mechanisms or move forward just in a ideological point of view?
Well, part of the problem also, you mentioned not knowing who you are, but of knowing that they are consciously disliked and impoverished and stigmatized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's the number of times I have heard like fellow staff people in healthcare say, I have such a hard time dealing with these people, and these sheer otheringness of these statements is disgusting. Just, there's so much alienness in perception and in just not wanting to deal with the problem and in wanting to blame the victim. It's...
I mean, I think one of what this conversation ultimately comes down to is we can come up with any solutions we like about how to get resources where they need to be, how to increase funding, how to actually ensure people have clean water. And those are all important things that need to be done. But at the end of the day, any issue affecting the First Nations community of Canada can be traced to, you know, the systematic destruction of culture wrought by colonialization.
Let's let the historian speak in on that.
Okay, but just to finish the thought, and I mean, you can't fix any of these smaller problems without addressing that. That's the only way. That's the only way I can see that we can make any progress here.
Michael, I am going to ask you to try to put in a nutshell for listeners, which is an impossible task, given the like magnitude of the situation. Could you describe sort of the systematic colonial destruction and what exactly has happened through the ages in Canada?
We do not only have the case of signing treaties, then violating them, and putting First Nations into smaller and smaller areas or relocating them to less productive areas. We also have the main culprit here for what we're talking about is residential schools taking children away from their communities, quote unquote, educating them, usually not very well, sending them back into the world after extreme amounts of abuse in many cases. They're not receiving the cultural knowledge that their parents would have given them, which would have helped alleviate these issues. The cycle of abuse continues from there. Things get worse.
If you want to look at developing a borderline personality, antisocial personality, depression, anxiety, social phobia, whatever, if you have, or PTSD, a lot of these things may or may not have risk factors of abuse in the past. And the problem with a lot of, particularly personality disorders, is it's often the sort of perpetuating cycle of you have the person who has this issue, which then passes it on to the children. So you basically created, by being the colonial power in the situation, created a broken community. And then you blame the broken community for being that way. So that's very depressing. Any last notes on this one? It's the thing that I feel, I don't want to say guilty about, but that whenever I think of it, I am honestly, as a physician, I just kind of go, I just don't know what to do. I don't know where to start. I could say sorry 1,000 times. I could try to help.
I want to ask now is to what extent cultural training would help among physicians to at least make those attitudes you were discussing earlier, at least make people consider their viewpoints on these, because a lot of it comes out of ignorance of that's not my field. I'm just looking at what's in front of me, right?
Yeah. And it's not necessarily always physicians. When I say staff, I mean everyone in a hospital. So nursing, OT, lab, whatever. I think it is very helpful. The problem whenever we had cultural training things is that most of them, when they were led by, you know, people from the culture being like, hey, I'm from Port Chip, nice to meet you, you know, or whatever, that was usually fine. But then there were times where it's like, you know, one white person talking to another white person about how to interact.
That seemed
really weird.
You're getting into the caveat we made at the beginning of this conversation, which is you've got well-meaning white people who still have no idea what it's like to actually be a member of that community.
Yeah. The one thing
I think, like I've said a couple times now, the only way any progress is going to be made is in making policies and shaping policies to the betterment of First Nations that the First Nations have a hand in making. Like, you need to listen to these communities, you need to hear what their concerns are, and hear what their solutions are as well. And I don't see how any progress can be made unless you start there.
Just to add to kind of what Michael was asking me, there was one thing that I did, which is I did a spiritual elective. So I went around to various chaplains, but in the chaplaincy group at the University of Alberta Hospital was also a First Nations counselors as well, who were specifically sort of the cultural focus there. And I found, it was like two afternoons or one afternoon, which is not very long, was interacting with this person and with other people in their culture was phenomenally helpful. That's one person spending an afternoon with one person. Mm-hmm. And so then I don't know. Let's move on. All right. Next one is, to me, not to downplay anything we've said so far about these other issues, the biggest issue that I think is currently going to destroy the Canadian healthcare system is geriatric admissions to hospital and being stuck in hospital and the lack of long-term care facilities, the lack of care for geriatrics. A geriatric patient is generally considered anyone over the age of 65. And generally the people that get admitted to hospital, they have a lot of medical diagnoses. They have a lot of what are called comorbidities of one issue leads to another issue, another issue, another issue. They have poor health. Probably their family did not plan for them to get old, to lose function. Families may be scattered these days. Families may not be getting along well. People start to lose cognitive functioning or physical functioning and need more help. We do have, in each province, we have some kind of community access providers who will come and do some supportive care, but you can't generally keep everyone at home well, secondary to agitation, cognitive decline and safety, being able to physically be at home, because some people may need 24-hour care, which isn't available in the community generally. There wouldn't be enough funding for that. So, these people come into hospital, and often people who come into hospital who are geriatric and maybe then waiting for long-term care. And then to wait for long-term care means you have to have a bed to go to a place that is available. Because a lot of long-term care facilities, you know, have people in them. So I have had numerous times in my training where I've been having a person who is effectively waiting for someone else in long-term care to die to leave the hospital. My understanding is that there's very little funding put toward long-term care facilities. And there's the whole, you know, there's the book Being Mortal by Atul Gawande. That's a great analysis of how we even consider taking care of geriatric patients. And the idea that of putting them into places versus keeping them at home versus having family members, you know, support them into their older adulthood. And I'm just going to end up my little spiel with a little comment that a colleague made, which is that it's our own fault in healthcare for making people live this long. And now we have to bear the fallout of that, which is that people who live longer generally have poor health. I mean, centenarians, some of them run marathons. Most of them don't. There you go. So, how are we going to fix
the aging population problem?
Yeah, how are we going to fix this one?
Okay, so I'm not advocating this as an approach by any means. I feel just somebody's got to mention it.
A time is going to deal with it in its own way, yeah?
Yeah, so if you want to take the purely utilitarian approach, euthanasia. Now, I don't think that's the best approach. I think there are many, many reasons it's not a good idea. But, I mean, it does solve the problem. It creates a million others, but it does solve this one.
It creates ethical problems. I don't know that it creates practical problems. This is just the thing, is that right now, the medical assistance in dying, which is now the new soft terminology coming up for killing people for them, is last year, I think, was it last year? I can't even remember now, made legal under the Supreme Court of Canada. Exactly how this is going to look and what it's going to look like is still sort of in debate. I think it has started, though. I think it is something that is happening now. But as this funding crisis happens, because you have to understand that a person being held in hospital, like, their bed can cost the healthcare system $2,000 to $5,000 a day, depending on where they are. And if they can't go anywhere else, that's a lot of money being spent on someone who's just sitting there getting nursing care. So it's very tempting. Very tempting, I think.
I don't know, just as far as I can tell, like, I can't see any practical, humane solution coming out of this that isn't going to cost a lot of money. Okay, so we need more long-term care facilities. Build more long-term care facilities. That costs money. We need more at-home support workers. That costs money. You know, we need more beds in the hospitals or bigger hospitals. That costs money. I mean, I don't think this is a problem you're going to solve just by throwing money at it, but I don't think it's a problem you're going to solve either without also throwing money at it.
I want to know how abstract we want to be getting with this, too. I feel like there's
you
a
can go as abstract as you like
for me to look at this issue and say something that is not... that cannot be implemented in any kind of practical terms.
Well, give it a shot.
As Corey said, we go to the obvious things that we can or are considered now of we need more long-term care beds. Make more. That weighs on the taxpayer.
How do you staff them? How do you fund for it? Yeah.
You come to it from a cultural perspective. Families in Canada tend to spread out and people in them are independent of each other. So you can't count on children looking after or providing that level of care to parents or grandparents here.
And you have to remember there's a certain number of people where families really hate each other. This also happens.
And it's not a case as in certain other countries where it doesn't matter if people in your family hate each other. They need to stay together. That's not the case. When you have people spread out and independence highly prized among people, that I think would have a psychological and therefore a health effect on people as they grow older and they feel more and more useless and unable to take care of themselves, which probably ends up indirectly leading to more disease and more issues.
Depression and anxiety among geriatrics is large, even independent of effects caused by dementia.
Exactly. And that involves cultural shifts of how can you make your older population feel more integrated into the community and more useful?
One of the things I do love is when you have a co-made long-term care facility where you either, as I think in the Netherlands, have college students get free room and board if they hang out for an hour a day with a geriatric
person. Yes, I saw that video too.
Yeah, or, as I've heard of before, also integrating child care facilities so that people who are working can drop the kids off at daycare. The daycare is integrated with the long-term care facility. Daycare being something that can generate funding.
Which brings us back to a much older model for how kids were raised.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know what? Our parents' generation and their parents' generation seem to turn out more or less functioning, so it might not be a bad thing.
Look who got through, look who got through the barricade. Hi, Niall.
So clearly we need daycares staffed by babushkas. I mean...
Yeah, there you go. I think also one of the things that I was trying to impress, that for $5,000 to $2,000 a day per person, you could really build a group home or some kind of facility and staff
like
it.
Like the Baba Yaga's home in France somewhere. If you ever heard that documentary.
But it's so hard to explain to people that the person sitting in hospital is going to destroy your healthcare system. Whereas if you put something into like a group home where you could host four seniors in a house with two staff members potentially caring for them, would work great. But it's really hard. And I think it's because it's not a particularly sexy topic to talk about. And it's at this time of the year, coming up to Christmas, I'm always so annoyed because there's so many funding drives for pediatrics, for like Sick Kids Hospital or the Stollery Hospital or CHEO. And it's like, you know, these kids at Christmas who are sick, help them. Well, for every kid who's sick, there's a lot of older people who are a lot more sick, I think. And it's unfair that nobody has funding drives for them. Because we don't think of our elders in our society. We just tend to forget them and let them be lonely and miserable by themselves. So yeah, that's also very depressing. Last one on this wonderful ride through things that make me sad on a daily basis.
Tour.
Yeah.
Mystery or misery?
Yeah.
I don't know, I think the phrase magical misery tour has a nice ring to it.
And on that note, I think that's a good place to sort of wind this down. Any last comments and things we've talked about now that you're all thoroughly depressed?
Oh, we've been depressed for most of 2016.
Well, yeah, 2016 has been a bad year.
Yeah. I don't know what I can add at this point that wouldn't just be reiterating what we've already said. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, these are not simple issues. There are not going to be simple solutions. But anybody who expects them to be, I think, is kind of self-deluding, quite frankly. Like, the notion that this is going to be solved overnight is a pipe dream. It's not going to happen. And so we need to be willing to put in the time and the effort to make it work.
I actually don't think that any of these things are going to be solved. I think that these things will continue to sort of carry along until a crisis happens, and then we'll, as a group, get through that crisis. But I don't think there's going to be a solution. Because as far as I can see, people haven't. The general population is not uniting to solve it. So I don't think it will happen, and everything else is just trying to put bandages on, and I think we're going to continue to do that until our healthcare system breaks.
As you say,
It's sad because I'm a diehard socialist, and I love a public healthcare system.
As you say, so basically what you're building up to is it's not going to get fixed until it's so broken it needs to be rebuilt.
That's what I think, and I think that is going to lead to probably worse issues.
Yeah, you do not... As is the usual case, yes, we can look forward to what gets rebuilt, but we do not want to live through the breakdown. All I can say is that going by what we've been doing on this podcast, cross-disciplinary approaches are useful because these issues are never just limited to one specific field. They always bleed out into various areas, and those areas should also be considered.
I hope you all have good health. And you can always find me at iatropexy.wordpress.com. I'm Marie Gautrek.
I'm Michael. You can find me at onelastsketch.wordpress.com and on Twitter at onelastsketch. I have my own podcast called, funnily enough, the One Last Sketch Podcast, where you could hear these two lovely people fairly regularly as well.
It's amazing. It's like it's just the three of us talking. Corey, where can we find you?
And I'm Corey, and I finally decided to develop an online presence. You can find me at fromspeechfire.wordpress.com.
All right. This has been disheartening.
But it's also been the Atropology Podcast.
Illuminating.
Clap for no discernible reason.
Don't we normally do that?
Is
that
no, people.
Yeah, I'm gonna ignore that.
What do you mean, you people?
Why do I hang out with you guys? Oh, wait. Because I don't have other friends. Okay.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad you know that whole wedding thing was
that's
you know,
going
important.
In.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of the Latin phrase that means that. what is it?
Don't look at me.
Oh no.
You're the one who's.
Oh, man. It's not ipso facto. Do you want to pick him up? Oh, then he'll play with the cord, won't he?
What's nice is I don't have to edit this one.
Bad kitty.
I read a comic of the 75 years of Aquaman.
Oh boy.
I enjoyed it. I'm like, I actually quite like Aquaman now.
Oh, I'm going to put on socks is what I'm going to do right now.
Come on. Let's go downstairs, kitten. Let's go downstairs so I can barricade you. Come on.